This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might have expected that a biography of Ronald Reagan would be in the news for its new revelations about the former president. But what's making news is the author himself and the approach he's taken. My guest is Edmund Morris, who spent the past 14 years working on this new biography of Ronald Reagan. Reagan and his staff chose Morris to write the president's biography and gave him access to Reagan and his papers. But for years, in spite of Morris's special access, he felt unable to penetrate Ronald Reagan's inner life. To get around this, Morris came up with the device of creating a fictional narrator, bearing the author's name, Edmund Morris, who was with Reagan at key moments of his life, moments that the real Morris couldn't possibly have been there for. This has set off a heated debate among historians and biographers. In 1980, Morris won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Teddy Roosevelt. I asked Morris why he created a fictionalized version of himself instead of just including his subjective observations and conclusions as Reagan's biographer.
Ronald Reagan was a magical phenomenon. I became aware when I was with him that what seemed so ordinary in private, sometimes alarmingly ordinary, transformed within a split second into something magical whenever he stepped out of the public, out of the private arena and into the public. And the mystery of this transformation, which has much to do with the mysteries of theater, fascinated me. And I knew that I had to devolve a literary device which would convey the phenomenon of Reagan the performer. He was a performer all his life. I'm not being pejorative in calling him a performer. In fact, I admire the thespian community profoundly. But the device had to show his theatrical and cinematic magic.
You admire him as a performer. Did you admire him as a politician and president?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. That's quite obvious to anybody who reads the book.
What are some of the biggest problems President Reagan presented to you as a subject?
His inscrutability, his personal inscrutability, was a major problem because naturally biographers are always concerned about and curious about the inner man. And Ronald Reagan, on first acquaintance, appeared to have no inner man at all. A metaphor that came to me and which I use in the book, I think, is that he was like alabaster, this beautiful polished exterior with visible walls and convolutions beneath the surface, but it was impossible to probe my fingers past that hard gloss outside. And I should explain that the reason that he was so inscrutable was that he was not very curious about himself. He was not a reflective, self-analytical, self-doubting man. He lacked curiosity about himself. He was supremely sure of his rightness and his strength and his vision, and therefore was very difficult to interview.
Well, you're right. What you see is what you get is what several of his intimates had warned you when you asked about his hidden depths. Nevertheless, you say, you couldn't believe how little one got and how shallow those depths appeared to be. Did you find President Reagan to be a shallow person?
Yes and no. The metaphor of the alabaster applies. The surface polish seemed to be shallow. The things that he would say in private were sometimes alarmingly banal. They were so surpassingly ordinary that I couldn't understand how such a man could be the leader of the free world. But as the years went by, and as I began to take him much, much more seriously, and as I began to study the manuscripts that he'd written as a young man, analyze his performances as an actor, read his diaries, talk to those who knew him or who thought they knew him, I realized that this man was revealing more and more and more depths which I had to plumb in some fashion.
Can you give an example of one of your frustrating encounters with him when you were trying to interview him?
I do remember saying to him once, in frustration, that I couldn't understand him. And he seemed genuinely shocked and said, "Why, I'm an open book." And I said, "Yes, Mr. President, but all your pages are blank."
To which he said what?
He was just, Reagan was naive. He had this almost boyish naivete. He was surprised that I should find him strange. He was surprised, in fact, that that I was interested in what was there inside him, because he was only interested in exterior things. So that was an example of the fact that I couldn't penetrate him by conventional means. But the real Ronald Reagan was revealed in the writings that he left behind. He was a copious writer, by the way, which people don't generally understand. A lucid, energetic, and copious writer. All his speeches before he became president, and indeed many of his speeches while he was president in the first term, he wrote out in his own patient, laborious handwriting. And being a writer, I can identify with script on the page. I can see the lucidity of his mind, the effortless sequences of his thoughts. And as I read these manuscripts, I realized this is a bright and formidable intellect.
Well, give us a sense of some of his writings as a young man and what you think those writings revealed about Ronald Reagan.
Oh, they're fascinating. Because as the writings of most young men are, they were full of unconscious self-portraits. Through all these stories, most of which are to do with young men wanting glory on the football field, or young men attracting girls as they work as lifeguards. In the midst of all these stories is this recognizable central figure. He's always tall, handsome, dreamy, attractive to women, but somehow aloof from them. This figure recurs again and again and again, and it's palpably the Ronald Reagan we saw in the White House.
Now, are these short stories that you're talking about, or diary
yes,
entries?
Many, yeah, no, I'm talking about short stories and essays.
Mm-hmm.
He flattered himself when he was young. This is, his early college years, the period between, 1927 and 1932. He rather flattered himself that he was a good writer. And, in fact, he was. He had astonishing flights of imagination, which come out in these short stories, and which were later sublimated into his acting career. To give you one example, he describes the same ubiquitous, elegant, aloof, handsome young man coming back to college for his final senior year, getting off the bus, walking down the tree-shaded streets of this town, which is recognizably Eureka, Illinois. And as the young man walks down the street toward his frat house, he suddenly finds himself accompanied by his three earlier student selves, the freshman, the sophomore, and the junior. The freshman is callow and awkward in his clothes. The sophomore is slightly more sophisticated. The junior is recognizably a maturing young man. And now the senior is the splendid individual. And the leap of imagination for Ronald Reagan at the age of 21 to think of himself in terms of a trio of doppelgangers is quite astonishing.
I don't actually find it that astonishing for someone who's trying to write fiction.
Well, it's an ingenious device. I've never seen that before. Mm-hmm. To be accompanied by three of oneself. We've often seen doppelganger literature where one talks about one's ghostly accompanist. But here Reagan, with supreme impartiality, is able to describe himself at three different stages of his life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have access to Ronald Reagan's journals?
Yes, his diaries as president, I did. I read them all, from page one to page, four volumes.
And what would you say are among the most interesting things they revealed about him as a man and as a president?
The most interesting thing is the complete absence of ego and the omnipresent presence of id. He had this enormous sense of personal identity and righteousness, as I've said just now, but amazingly, he had no ego. I've never read anybody's diary without being aware of the presence of the ego. But Reagan had none. In many ways, the diaries are deeply uninteresting because they have no particular insights into the personalities of any of the people that he met, no curiosity about what was going on around him, no self-analysis, no self-doubt. None of the things that generally make diaries fascinating. But when you read them through, you have this feeling of a huge, superbly engineered, supremely confident personality.
In what sense did he show no ego in these journals?
A total absence of self-congratulation. Any normal human being writing a diary in moments of triumph will express triumph on the page. Self-satisfaction, self-congratulation. Reagan just didn't think that way. The only thing which does strike you as you read them is the conscientiousness with which he tabulates how many times he was interrupted by applause in all his speeches. He would say, speech in Miami, Florida went fine today. I had three SOs, three standing ovations. I was interrupted by 17 bursts of applause. And on superficially, this might seem to be conceited note-taking, but actually it was not. It's the self-observation of a total professional checking out the effectiveness of his own performance.
My guest is Edmund Morris, author of the new biography of Ronald Reagan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Edmund Morris is my guest, the author of the new authorized biography of Ronald Reagan called Dutch, a Memoir. How is his memory when you started interviewing him? Ronald Reagan has had Alzheimer's for the past few years. You started speaking with him in 1985 for this book. How is his memory then? Do you think that he had any signs of early Alzheimer's at that point?
Absolutely not. To me, Alzheimer's is dementia. It is bizarre thought processes, strange, illogical verbal statements. Reagan never lost his lucidity. What he did lose, is that as time went on, was the energy to concentrate entirely on events all through the day, every day. Like many old men who have had severe medical traumas, he conserved himself, and in his second term, he quite often spaced himself out. Whenever he was required to be active and to lead and to change and to negotiate, he came back with all his facilities. But I would like to talk about his memory, since I remember you using that word to begin with.
Yeah, please.
Reagan's memory was photographic and phonographic, which is to say, he remembered things with photographic accuracy, things that he'd seen, but even more impressively, he remembered things phonographically in the sense that he registered sound. He really was almost like a tape recorder in that respect. And there was an extremely dramatic example of that in the office, Oval Office one day when I was interviewing him about his youth in Des Moines, Iowa. And I was actually trying to find out about his sex life as a young man, so I said to him, what sort of things did you do at night, Mr. President, when you had time off? And he said, I used to go to the advertising club in Des Moines because that was the locale where we had the best speakers from out of town. And I would sit there listening to these speakers, and I learned a lot of the tricks of my trade from listening to those people. And he said, as a matter of fact, I remember one guy who came in from out of town who was presented to us as the chief executive of a toilet paper company. And he stood up and gave us a presentation about the manufacture of toilet paper, which was very witty and very funny. And it was only after a while we realized that it was actually a put-on. He was a professional comedian, and it was supposed to be a joke. So I'm sitting there listening to Reagan saying this. And Reagan says, as a matter of fact, I can remember every word of it today. And I said, you can, Mr. President? He said, yeah. He said, sometime when you've got time, I'll tell you about it. I said, oh, no, tell me now, please. I have this on tape. And his face changed. His eyes went dull. He inflated his lungs. His voice became high-pitched. And out of his mouth pours about 12 minutes of word-for-word recitation of the speech he heard once in 1933, the Advertising Club of Des Moines. It was not particularly funny anymore by conventional standards. This is what passed for humor in 1933. But what was uncanny was the way it poured out of him, almost as though he was a recording machine. And when he got to the end of this, I said in stupefaction, Mr. President, did you get a copy of his script and memorize it? And he said, oh, no, I've never thought about that until this moment.
Okay, well, that's one example of his memory. Let me tell you a story that was told to me here on Fresh Air when I was interviewing Michael Korda, who's the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, and edited President Reagan's memoirs. And Michael Korda was saying that the president was a great storyteller, but the problem was that being an actor, over the years, he tended to put himself more and more in the foreground of the story. And I'll quote Michael Korda here. He said, "Thus, Reagan put himself more and more in the foreground of the story. He told Yitzhak Rabin and everybody else that he'd been the first American to reach Buchenwald, the Nazi death camp, and see the horrors of the concentration camps. And when he told Rabin, Rabin burst into tears because the story was so wonderful and so moving. The only problem is, when we put it in the book, we discovered that it wasn't true. Ronald Reagan, of course, had never been outside the United States in the Second World War and spent the entire Second World War in Culver City editing footage from military photographers. He had seen the footage of American troops liberating Buchenwald, but over the years, as he told the story, he gradually moved himself into the foreground of the story, and so he was the one who liberated Buchenwald." Does this story jive with anything that you found with Ronald Reagan?
Yes, absolutely. But I take a much more a constructive view of it than Michael does. Although I must say, when I read Michael's account, I was convulsed with laughter. It's very funny. I have indeed asked Reagan about that myself, and let me tell you the essence of it. Reagan was the top bureaucratic officer at the first motion picture unit of the Army Air Forces in World War II. And in April of 1945... units of the first motion picture unit went into Ohrdruf and Buchenwald and Ravensbrück with Eisenhower's soldiers and photographed, they produced the first raw film, documentary film, of the indescribable horrors that were inside. And this raw film was airlifted back to the United States for processing back in Culver City, where Reagan was adjutant. And as the officer on the base with the highest intelligence clearing, he had to sit every day watching this unimaginable footage unreeling in raw form on the screen in order to have it cut up and processed and sent to the Pentagon for General Arnold to view. So here's Ronald Reagan, a creature of the screen and a child of the screen, sitting there morning after morning viewing the raw reality of the Holocaust. I've seen some of this film myself, and I was sick for days afterwards. He saw it. He was so transformed by it that when he was demobbed a few months later, he actually snuck some of these reels out of the base and took them home with him to show to his sons when they respectively turned 14 years of old, to communicate to them the essence of the Holocaust. Now, in these days of virtual reality, I ask you, was he seeing reality or was he not? I can quite believe that as far as he was concerned, he was there.
I don't know. I think we've all had the experience of being just terribly moved or disturbed by movies that we've seen, whether the movies are fiction or documentaries. But I'm not sure that that would excuse any of us from assuming that we were actually an important figure in that story and that we were the hero of that story, the first reporter to report on it. I mean,
no, I'm sorry, that's nonsense. He never presented himself as the hero of the story. He simply said that he was there as a witness. And occasionally when he told the story, he would say, "I was there at the liberation of the camp." Absolutely, he never would have said that I was the leader of the liberation. I'm sorry, that's Michael's memory.
Uh-huh, but it doesn't bother you that he thought he was there and what he'd done was see the movie? I mean, that seems like a really big difference to me, being truly moved by what you've seen because you saw the documentation and actually believing you were there when you weren't either a reporter or a soldier during World War II.
I'm not defending him, Terry. I am describing him. I'm describing a mysterious man. What I'm saying is that his emotions at what he saw were utterly genuine and transformed his character to a permanent degree.
Edmund Morris is the author of the new biography of Ronald Reagan. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Edmund Morris, author of the controversial new biography of Ronald Reagan. Now, your biography of Reagan starts at Bitburg, the German cemetery in which members of the SS were buried. He was
He was
urged to not speak there, and through speaking there, honor the SS who were buried there. So I'm wondering why you start your biography of him at Bitburg and what that story signifies in your larger biography.
Because that was the moment, the precise moment when I realized I just had to write this book. When I sat, like millions of other citizens around the world, watching Ronald Reagan coming out of the Documenten House at the induction center at Bergen-Belsen, looking around him at the green field of Bergen-Belsen, absolutely ravaged by what he'd just seen, these photographs inside the house, and having to step forward and articulate one of the truly great speeches of his presidency. I remember him coming out of that house, looking at the gray sky, and I remember hearing through the soundtrack of my television the cheep of a German Lerch, a skylark. And I don't know what it was. It's a combination of the gray sky and the expression on his face and the sound of that bird and the poignance of that moment. That's when I realized this is a huge moral drama that has been enacted here on the green field of Bergen-Belsen. And God, I wish I was there to describe this.
And what was the moral drama?
The moral drama was the conflict of memory between the Judaic religion and the Christian religion. Ronald Reagan, in a primitive way, was a simple, totally believing Christian. And to him, the idea of forgiveness and forgetting was a paramount part of the Christian faith. He felt that after 40 years, the Holocaust could at last be forgotten, put an end to, and we should go forward to bright new fields and a new tomorrow. That is the Christian sentimentality, that the past can be transcended. The Jews know that the past can never be forgotten. So it was a conflict between the two basic sentiments of Judaism and Christianity. Enormously dramatic, perfect for literature, and it is that kind of moral drama that I wanted to write about and make at the center, core of this biography.
Why do you think he decided to speak at Bitburg? Because of forgiveness?
He was asked to do this by Chancellor Kohl, Helmut Kohl of West Germany, who begged him in the Oval Office, literally with tears in his eyes, to make a gesture of reconciliation to the German people. And he said, in effect, to the president, this is the end of 1984, will you come to Germany on the 40th anniversary of the end of World War II, and will you clasp hands with me at some field where our soldiers lie buried so that we can finally put to an end the ancient divisions that have divided us. And Reagan just loved that kind of notion and committed himself to going. When the decision to go to Bitburg was announced in the spring of 1985, and it was discovered that this cemetery at Bitburg contained, amongst other graves, the graves of SS members, all hell broke loose. Jews across the world were outraged that the President of the United States should be going to Germany and do honor to the perpetrators of the concentration camps. And this outcry developed, led most eloquently by Elie Wiesel. "Mr. President," to quote Wiesel's words, "that is not your place. You must not go there." And Reagan, withstanding the first major crisis of his presidency, obstinately insisted on going forward and keeping his commitment, which he did do, but the palliative that he offered, was persuaded to offer, was to go to Bergen-Belsen as well, and that's where this great drama took place.
My guest is Edmund Morris, and his new biography of Ronald Reagan has just been published, and it's an authorized biography of the former president. Because Ronald Reagan so emphasized family values, I'm interested in his family. You describe his father as, quote, a shoe salesman, lapsed Catholic, wanderer, and binge drinker. What kind of relationship did they have?
Reagan, my impression was that he secretly disapproved of his father, in the sense, although he had an affection for him, but he disapproved of his father's weakness. Reagan was a very strong man, and he admired strength in other people. Therefore, he admired his very strong mother. He admired strong men and strong women. He saw weakness in his father, and he had a deep moral disapproval of that.
Now, you write about how between marriages to Jane Wyman and Nancy Davis, he had a lot of girlfriends in Hollywood. You write, "My research cards show him stepping out with at least 16 different young and beautiful actresses, from Doris Day and Rhonda Fleming to Piper Laurie. He did admit once to sleeping with so many girls that the morning came when he did not know who one of them was. I'll discreetly leave it at that." Did his life jive with the values that he professed and the legislation that he supported in terms of, family values?
That was the interstice between his two marriages, and he certainly covered the waterfront and used to talk about it quite frankly later. I remember Bob Novak I bumped into the other day, the columnist, and he's telling me that he took a plane ride with Reagan in 1976 and spent 2 hours with him, and the future president spent all that time telling him about those wild years in Hollywood when he was sleeping with a lot of extraordinarily gorgeous women. So Ronald Reagan was a real man and a real guy. However, he was almost pathologically faithful when he was married. He was uxorious and faithful and old-fashioned and traditional.
But still, the way that he slept with a lot of women in between marriages seems to be exactly one of the kind of things he would have been very moralistic about in his years in the White House.
That's true, but many horny young men become moralistic later on in life. He became quite prudish as president. He didn't like sex on the screen, got very upset about it. He had a surprising enjoyment of really lusty male jokes, but it had to be in male company only. He got very embarrassed if anybody told a faintly risque joke in front of women. In that way, he was almost touchingly old-fashioned. He would blush and be very embarrassed.
What kind of father was he?
He was an almost absentee father. When he was with his children, which was infrequently, for example, young Michael, the one who was most starved for parental affection, young Michael had his father every Saturday afternoon during his teenage years at the ranch. And Michael told me very touchingly once, he said, "Those afternoons were those wonderful moments of my life. But for the 6.5 days in between those afternoons, his father was totally absent." So all the children, in their respective fashion, to this day, you can sense their starvation for this large, lovable, magical man who was hardly ever with them. He was always away, on the road for General Electric, or on the set for movies, or in the State House as governor, and in the White House as president. He was always doing the business of the world and had very little time for them.
You write, "In one respect, Ron and Nancy were model parents, and that was at family photo opportunities."
Yes, absolutely. There are comical moments when Patty Davis would say to him, in the later stages when the family had reached the point of dysfunctionality, she would say to him, "Dad, don't you understand, my traumas as a teenager, and you never knew about them because Mommy wouldn't tell you about them." And he would say, "But Patty, we were so happy as a family. Look at all those Christmas pictures. We look so happy together." He identified the annual family Christmas picture as evidence that it was a happy family, whereas anything but. I'm sorry to say that as I talk to you now, three of his children are totally, totally alienated from their mother.
You mean not on speaking terms?
Yes, they just do not communicate. Ron and Patty and Michael. Although I think Michael does go around to see her occasionally, but it's a very stiff relationship.
Did they also cut off relations with their father?
Oh, no, they adore him still. And they try to see him when they can, and it's not easy for them.
Mm-hmm. After having completed Ronald Reagan's biography, are you still left with some of the impressions that you started with, that this was a man who was intellectually limited, a man who wasn't reflective, a man who was a cultural yahoo, is the word you once used.
Oh, no, I don't think that he ever changed in that respect. Culture did not darken his door in the later years of his life. He never showed any great curiosity about the characters and the opinions of people around him. In that sense, he was limited. But they were the obvious signs of his greatness. This man was concerned only with large matters of consequence for the entire country, and he was not concerned with ordinary simplicities.
Of course, his policies affected culture, even though he wasn't interested or concerned with it.
That's true, that's true. He had no particular admiration for the fine arts or need for it. His own aesthetic sensibilities, insofar as he had any, were almost comically primitive. I mean, his idea of a transcendent piece of art would be a ghastly leather cutout of a cowboy jogging along against a background of cutout leather mountains, or pictures of horses in his ranch hanging slightly crooked. That was his idea of aesthetic bliss.
Well, Edmund Morris, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Ms. Grice. It's a pleasure.
Edmund Morris is the author of the new biography of Ronald Reagan. This is Fresh Air.